Oh, yes, it's that time again. Time for your Friday Night Fright. This edition of Unexplained Incorporated is the monthly case study featuring Phantom Phil and Angel Card Amy. The case study begins right now. Yes, true believers, happy Good Friday to you. It is that time again for the monthly case study. And today, Angel Card Amy and myself are celebrating the one-year anniversary of the case study as of April 2020. Before she joined me, I did The Exorcist all by myself. That was the very first case study in the history of Unexplained Incorporated. But now I got Amy with me, and then two very special guests are going to be joining us in about half hour or so. So, this one, I promised we were doing a double dose of Johnny Depp. We did Sleepy Hollow in March. Amy chose that one, and I chose From Hell for April, which is a story about Johnny. He's another troubled inspector in this one, and instead of chasing the Headless Horseman, he's chasing down Jack the Ripper. And we're going to get into the true story and the esoteric and occult connections and the Freemasonic connections to this real life story later on. But first, Amy and I are going to break down the film. Amy, thank you so much for joining me today. Overall, I know you had some problems with the pacing of this film, but what did you think overall before I start breaking it down?
Oh, hi, Phil. Yeah, it was a good movie. It was the first time I've watched it since it actually came out to theaters. It was good. There's quite a bit of action towards the end of the movie, but I did find it was a little slow in the beginning. Overall, it was not so bad.
Not so bad. Yeah, I know you enjoyed Sleepy Hollow a lot more. My only complaint on this movie, and it's a very minor one, is I think it goes about 15 minutes too long. It clocks in just over 2 hours, and if they ended it around like the hour 45 mark, I don't think it would have hurt the story, and I think the film maybe would have been a little bit better. But overall, this is a very good film, very character-driven.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Okay, good. So a little bit of info before we run things down. Interesting choice of executive producers and directors on this one. The film was distributed by 20th Century Fox. We have Alan and Albert, the Hughes brothers. Some of their past work includes such heavily influenced films with social commentary like Menace to Society and Dead Presidents. And then later on in 2010, I believe, they would direct the post-apocalyptic thriller The Book of Eli. So I read, this film is also based on a graphic novel, which we're going to talk about just before our guests come on. But the Hughes brothers apparently butted heads about the amount of gore and violence shown in this movie. One of them thought it didn't show enough, and the other one thought it was just right, and implying a lot of the gore was the way to go. Now, Amy, I noticed this movie, a lot of the gore and the violence was implied at the beginning, and then it just seemed to get more and more extreme as the story built up and the film went on. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially near quite interesting. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, apparently it was going to be that gory the whole way through, but after they butted heads, and even though they were executive producers, I guess the Fox Studios won and said, you got to cut some of this violence out, or otherwise we're going to get an NC-17 rating, and we're going to lose a big portion of the movie-going audience if we don't. I kind of like this move because I think the less of what you see, in fact, makes it more scary. Do you agree with that?
True, yeah.
Yeah, you feel the same way? Because, I mean, it all builds up into a final crescendo in the final act, and I kind of like having it described instead of shown makes it that much more creepy, and the whole story and the violence aspect is creepy anyway. So this is where it gets interesting, the cast. These characters were all in the graphic novel of From Hell, but they were also based on real-life people, which we're going to talk about later on. Johnny Depp plays Inspector Frederick Aberline. Aberline, I think. Heather Graham is Mary Kelly. Ian Holm gives an excellent performance as Sir William Gull, the doctor who, spoiler alert, we find out in the movie anyway. He's the one doing all the grisly killings. Robbie Coltrane, another excellent, underrated British actor. He plays Inspector Peter Godley, who's like the, he's like the straight arrow to the kind of unhinged genius that is Frederick Aberline, Johnny Depp's character. Ian Richardson is Sir Charles Warren, who's Aberline's boss. They don't give his actual police title, but I assume he's like the chief or the commissioner of the London police back then, or at least that aspect of it. Ian McNeice, he plays coroner Robert Drudge, who is also a drunk in this movie. I thought that was a nice touch, as he's the one supposed to be examining and doing all the autopsies, and yet he could barely hold it together, and he's drunk on top of it. And Amy, you wanted to talk about this briefly. There was also a random cameo by Joseph Merrick, who was known as the Elephant Man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that scene was pretty creepy.
Like, what did you think when you saw that kind of random cameo?
Yeah, I totally forgot about that scene until I watched it. I was like, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, it had been a number of years since between viewings for me, and I'd forgotten all about that scene, too, and it was pretty startling. The Elephant Man was a David Lynch movie starring John Hurt, and it was based on the true story of a man who was based out of the London Hospital in that neighborhood at that time. And the fact that they tied it into this movie, it was creepy, but it was kind of cool at the same time to get the timeline down pat. So some other casting decisions, some considerations to play Frederick Aberline were Daniel Day-Lewis and, believe it or not, Sean Connery, who I read was actually on board with the project, but then had to leave. Yeah. Before they got Johnny Depp in, but Johnny Depp, as usual, did a great job. Gall was supposed to be played by the great British actor Nigel Hawthorne, who I think would have been really good too, but then he found out during filming he had cancer, which turned out to be terminal. So unfortunately, they couldn't have him there. This was mostly filmed in studios in the UK, but a lot of the London sets were actually filmed on a soundstage in Prague of the Czech Republic, because apparently that's where the Hughes brothers reside. So I found that interesting too, but it really looked like 1800s London. And in fact, the story takes place in the year 1888. Going to get to that connection to the year a little bit later on, as when we explore things a bit further, we're going to find out a lot of numbers and symbols have a weird, esoteric, energetic meaning behind them. And I thought when we see Jack the Ripper's first kill, it's right below like a dragon gargoyle on a building. So I think that was very symbolic as well. So right now, I just want to talk briefly about Inspector Aberline as one aspect of unexplained phenomenon tying this movie together is that he has visions and intuitions. Now, Ralph Sarchi in Deliver Us From Evil had these same hunches and intuitions as well, except Aberline is hooked on substances like opium and absinthe, and he's doing it all to drown out the loss of his wife, who died, who he lost his wife and baby during childbirth. Amy, I thought this was a very similar character arc to Ichabod Crane, because he was grieving the loss of his mother, and here Aberline is grieving the loss of his family.
Yes, I agree. Also, I noticed in that scene he was putting something in the absinthe. I think it was poison. He was like poisoning himself. The bottle said poison on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that stuff practically is poison. And I think it just goes to show that the character is having, you know, borderline suicidal thoughts, which makes him a bit of a loose cannon in this case. And don't quote me on this, but I think absinthe was made illegal like sometime in the 1900s because of the health risk and the horrific hallucinations it could give you. So I find it interesting that that's his aid in his, you know, psychic visions or his intuitions. And take that for what it's worth. But either way, absinthe would be outlawed, and this is probably a good example as to why. So once the killings start happening, so a bunch of working girls, will say, all end up getting killed in the Whitechapel neighborhood of London, England in the 1888. Johnny Depp and Robbie Coltrane start to investigate this, and not only do they see the grisliness of these murders, they find patterns as well. And we get the old story arc of whenever the inspector takes it to authority, they say, oh no, a surgeon or a doctor couldn't do this, an educated man couldn't do this. Maybe it was one of those Indians or one of the Jews. So like they're already using this xenophobic attitude to deflect the investigation and to derail it and what's really going on, as we're going to find out later on. In fact, Jack's killings are a distraction to basically scare the people in London and that neighborhood and take their eye off the real crisis, which we find out later on is the royal prince marrying one of these working girls and bearing a child before marriage, and that child, who's baby Alice, could end up inheriting the throne through the bloodline rules and possibly destroying the British Empire. And we find out later in the movie this prince is the grandson of Queen Victoria, and it is told that he actually has the disease of syphilis and he's dying. Now here's where it gets really interesting. We find out that whoever the Jack the Ripper is, because the character doesn't get revealed until near the end, is a Freemason who is fulfilling a duty, killing traitors to the Mason, order in a ritualistic manner. Now, I'm going to talk about this once the guests come on, but there is a long feud, and dare I say hatred, between Catholicism and Freemasonry, which is why Prince Albert's marriage and wedlock was looked down upon by the Freemasons and the powerful people they were connected to. So we get that there's this whole big conspiracy going on, and we're going to find out later, maybe this conspiracy is a little bit more fact than fiction. We're going to explore that. It's going to get weird, but we're going to look into that. Another cool symbolic thing I want to bring up is the temptation with the grapes and the alcohol. Like when Jack is trying to lure the working girls, the ladies of the night, off the street, he uses grapes because they were an expensive, scarce commodity in that part of working class London. And then he tempts the alcoholic one with alcohol before he ends up murdering them. And I thought that was very similar to the symbolic nature of the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Did you have any additional thoughts on that, Amy?
Yeah, I think he put something in the alcohol because it made them kind of queasy. Thought that maybe he put something in the grape, but yeah, they were, I forget how they worded it, why they offered it to them. Something that they can't turn down. What's that word they used? Sorry, I have brain freeze. I can't remember that word they used.
Yeah, I know what you mean, though.
Mm-hmm, yeah, so it's like luring them into his carriage and then taking them to that alleyway.
And in the end, we, of course, find out that it is Sir William Gull behind all these murders in the movie, who is doubling as Jack the Ripper. And he is amongst the highest order of the Freemason Society. However, he goes so far overboard that the Masons don't want anything to do with him, that we find out. And not too long before I wrap on this and get into the graphic novel end of things that the movie's based on, I just want to say that I thought some of the major themes of this, the major theme of this movie, this story, is about sacrifice. And if you break it down like this, Aberline's wife gives her life during childbirth. Aberline sacrifices himself at the end of the movie to protect Mary, who is the one who ends up getting away from Jack the Ripper and fleeing the city to raise baby Alice. And with that, Mary is sacrificing her own life in the city to raise the baby out in the hills. And the Masons sacrifice Dr. Gull, because at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, he gets like a full-fledged lobotomy and is left to wither in a working house cell. The Freemason order sacrifices him in order to protect their secrecy and their order, instead of throwing him in jail where their secret and their whole scandal might be exposed. Mm-hmm. So yeah, sacrifice, a major theme in this movie, which I think they took from the graphic novel as well. And before we move on to the graphic novel, Amy, are there any additional thoughts you have on this film or some things I may have missed or not covered?
I did find what I was trying to mention earlier. When they, about the grapes, that the grapes, it says to make them trust whatever he offers them.
Yeah, that's where the the grapes and the alcohol come into play.
And then at the end, something to do with the pennies on the eyes. When they had put pennies on it, eyes.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. We have a bit of time to do that here. So growing up, playing a lot of video games, computer games, listening to music, I heard a lot about the River Styx in the Sales of Charon being Charron. And this kind of has some unexplained mythology attached to it. At some point in time throughout history, and I think this is covered a long period of time, it was customary in cultures like in England for survivors to put pennies on the eyes of the dead. And the reason for that being is that when they're crossed over and they needed a ride from the ferry on the Sails of Charon across the River Styx to the afterlife, they had to pay the ferryman, who's kind of like Death or the Grim Reaper or whatever you want to say, and he would collect the pennies off of their eyes. If the pennies weren't on their eyes, I guess their souls would remain in purgatory, which I find really interesting. And this gets pointed out at the beginning of the movie, and then in true narrative fashion, it goes full circle. And near the end, Inspector Aberline finally does himself in after he's been kind of teasing, overdosing, or poisoning himself throughout the whole movie. He finally does it once he realizes that he can't go live with Mary Kelly and baby Alice, because he will likely be hunted down by the Masons and the people in power, because he knows all the secrets to their whole scandal and their whole operation. So in a way, it's his own self-sacrifice. And I find it interesting because I also believe in a lot of cultures, if you end up committing suicide in any way, shape, or form, you're not crossing that river no matter what. So, but Inspector Godley puts the pennies on his eyes, and that's that for his character. So there's another strange afterlife connection. Is there anything else you want to share, Amy, or have I pretty well covered it before we get to the true events in the graphic novel?
I think you got it.
Okay, all right. So this movie, even though it was an adapted screenplay, like pretty much all of our case studies are here on Unexplained Incorporated, this was based on a graphic novel, otherwise known as like a teen or an adult comic book. It was written by Alan Moore, and some of the more cult-based themes in this movie were based off the graphic novel. However, they left quite a few out as well, because they can only fit this into a two-hour movie, where this graphic novel was a multiple-part series, kind of like a comic book. So Moore explores things like the fourth dimension, where the past, present, and future go on at the same time simultaneously. And this kind of explains where Dr. Gull feeds some of his delusions or his visions, because I'm going to talk about this when the guests come on, but I mean, one of his opening quotes is, you know, about how he's going to welcome in Usher in the 20th century. And how does he know this? Because he's in 1888 and you're still a little ways away from that new century. And in the novel, he says things like how history can be architecture, and that this take on the Ripper murders in the From Hell graphic novel is a symbolic apocalypse of the control of the Victorian age and into the new age of the 20th century. In the book, Gull's final murder, when he thinks he kills Mary Kelly but kills the French girl, apparently coincides with the conception of Adolf Hitler. And we also find out that before he gets lobotomized, Gull has visions of England in the 1990s, which is really cool. So apparently he's having all these clairvoyant visions of the future, and people just think he's nuts. But what he's doing is that he's trying to say that his ritualistic murders are bringing in the new evils of the 20th century, like Hitler and many others who followed him. And another interesting take I looked into this was that Gull's murders as Jack the Ripper were a manifestation of what would become male-dominated society, which I find very interesting because if you look at most of the evil characters of the 20th century, it's just about all men, right?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So the esoteric projections go a lot deeper in the graphic novel because, I mean, I guess they only had so much time to do it in the movie. And apparently in the books, Gull's character has a lot of out-of-body experiences and astral projection types of moments where he can be like multiple places at once. And like at the end, when he's performing the final murder, which is probably the most grisly one in the entire movie, he takes himself back to London Hospital, performing an operation that medical breakthrough where he's heralded as a hero, and he believes that the architect is talking to him. Now, the architect to Freemasonry is almost what God is to Catholicism and Christianity, so I just wanted to point that out. But either way, this William Gull character in the movie and in the graphic novel is pretty out there and makes a very convincing villain, and also leads to further theories on whether the real William Gull was actually Jack the Ripper or not. So at this time, Amy, we're going to take a small break, and then when we come back, we're going to be joined by Dan Cumerlotto from the Hamilton Ghost Walks and Jackie Trevelia, who's actually joining us from London and I believe knows the Whitechapel neighborhood quite well in the present day, and maybe has done some tours through there. We're going to ask her right when she gets on. But believe it or not, Dan in Hamilton, Ontario, when I went on his tour last summer, also showed the group a place in downtown Hamilton that may have housed a man who has another connection to Jack the Ripper. And that's why I want both of them on, and wanted both of them to share their stories. So we're going to break down what we think might be the true story. Then I want to go into the Freemasonry possible connection to the real life killings of Jack the Ripper and how this connects to their ongoing, clash with the Catholic Church. And it's going to take us to some real interesting places again, similar to the Sleepy Hollow case study. Are you ready for all this, Amy?
Yep. Let's do it.
Ready to go. All right. Yeah, let's do it indeed. We'll check back with you shortly with Dan Cumerlotto and Jackie Trevelia. Amy and I are now back from our break, and we are joined by not one, but two special guests. First guest was a man who was the first ever interview on Unexplained Incorporated in April of 2020. The man who runs Ghost Walks in Hamilton and Niagara, Dan Cumerlato. Dan, thank you for joining us today. How's it going with you so far early in this spring season?
It's going decently well, Phil. I can't complain. And I'm also happy to have the honor of being your very first guest and coming back. That's awesome.
Yeah, and you're one of the few that this is your third appearance on here. So yeah, we'll keep having you back. And our next guest joining us all the way from London, I believe, this is Jackie Trevelia. She was on here in February. We had such a fun time together. And there's a specific story with this subject matter that she wants to hear from Dan, which we'll get to shortly. But Jackie, at the time of this recording, apparently your neck of the woods is coming out of lockdown, maybe as early as tomorrow. Can you fill us in on that?
Yes, well, we will be coming out of lockdown tomorrow. But when we say coming out of lockdown, basically they're just easing some of the rules. So I'll be allowed to visit a couple of other people outdoors, which is very exciting. But we have a little way to go until we can actually have a full end of lockdown.
Yeah. Yeah, at least that's something. And here in Ontario, where the three of us are, things are kind of trending in the opposite direction, and we may be headed back into one. And actually, Dan's area is headed back into one tomorrow, but hopefully it doesn't last too long. So to start things off here, Amy and I have broken down the movie From Hell, which is about Jack the Ripper, on our monthly case study. Here on Good Friday, of course, when this is posting. I mean, what a better day. But I want to start with the breakdown of the true story and the speculations with Dan. Because when you think of Jack the Ripper and all the possible identities and the locations, you don't necessarily think of Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Yet, when I did his tour last August, Dan brought up a really cool connection about it, and one of the many people who might assume the identity of Jack the Ripper. So, Dan, first off, the floor is yours, and if you could share any info on that, that would be awesome.
Well, I don't know if I would call it a large connection, maybe a slight connection, but we're surrounding a historical character that was named Francis Tumblety. So Tumblety, back in the early 1800s, as he's growing up, he grew up in Rochester, New York. Now, if any of your listeners don't know, it's about a 3 or so hour drive from southern Ontario, so not too far away. So he grows up in Rochester, eventually realizes his dream of becoming an Indian herb doctor. That's what he called it, though. It was actually a con man. So they called it a snake oil salesman. And he would sell his amazing cures everywhere he went. People would believe it. When the cures didn't work, he'd be chased off to the next town of Suckers. And it was in 1856 that he came to our little town of Suckers. It was called Barton at the time. And he sold his amazing cure-all for everything. It actually sold, surprisingly. He had to leave Hamilton a year later. Now, they say it wasn't because they found out the cure didn't work. The story that goes along with it, and this is legend, so we're not 100% sure on this, but it is said that he got in trouble with the law, that he performed a literal back alley abortion on a local prostitute. And because of this, police want to talk to him. And if there's one thing we know about Tumblety, he knows when to get out of town. So he left, he went to Toronto, he went to Montreal, went to Boston in the U.S., hopped a boat over to England, into the Whitechapel district, and he just happened to arrive right at the same time around the year 1888.
Yeah, I mean, it would be so much to say that that's just a coincidence. Jackie, I wanted to ask you, have you, in your travels and your encounters, especially in that neighborhood, has that name or that story ever come up?
Yes, I have heard of Francis. I believe he was arrested for performing homosexual acts in 1888, yes, which, of course, was illegal at the time in England. And he also used to show off his collection of wounds from women. He was very proud of that. So I think he was an interesting character. And I know he did run off back to the United States when the English police decided they wanted to question him and potentially arrest him. But he was never extradited back because there wasn't any concrete proof that he was involved in the murders. But I've definitely heard of him. And I think he's a prime candidate, really, from everything I know and what you've just told me as well, Dan. I think he's an interesting character to look a bit more into.
Definitely an odd character, I'd say that for sure. But even after he died, he was buried in Rochester, and on his gravestone, he had them engrave it with Dr. Francis Tumblety, even though he wasn't a doctor, right? So it kind of gave a mindset of what type of person he was. And as well, one of the things that kind of led us to him being a potential suspect too, was the fact that he had medical knowledge, right? And there's rumors that the killer had medical knowledge?
Yeah, that's right. So from everything I've seen, there are a few similarities between all the murders. So actually, if I can go back just one step, you're probably aware of it, but a lot of people aren't aware there weren't just the five murders. So what actually happened was we had a spate of 11 deaths between 1888 and 1891, and those deaths all became known as the Whitechapel murders. So it was a single police investigation, but five of those deaths had enough similarities to believe that it was the works of one and the same person, a serial killer. And those five deaths in particular, as you just mentioned, they had so many similarities. One of them was the fact that generally they had their abdomen slashed, and some of them also had their female reproductive organs removed. But it was quite a clean incision, and that's why we believe that it was the work of a person with medical knowledge, definitely, because an ordinary person who didn't know what they were doing wouldn't be able to remove those organs so cleanly. But it doesn't necessarily just mean a doctor. It could have been a doctor, a nurse, or back in those days, butchers also could have been a butcher or a barber, because barbers, of course, would perform basic medical operations. You know, if you wanted something like a growth removed, or you needed something small cut off, you'd actually go down to your local barber. They'd even do teeth extractions while they're cutting your hair. So it probably was a doctor or a barber. That's something that people do agree with.
That's really interesting. If I could jump in for just a second, a lot to unpack there, Jackie, but just a couple of things you and Dan touched on is in breaking down the movie in the first half of this, Amy and I were talking about how when Johnny Depp's character of Inspector Aberline tries to go to his superiors and say, oh, this has to be the work of a doctor or a surgeon, and they basically turn around and say, oh, no, well, this isn't the work of an educated man. That's just not possible. The Tumblety theory makes a lot of sense with that connection, because he was basically pretending to be an educated man while he really wasn't, and he was more of a con artist. But while pretending to be a doctor or a surgeon or someone in the medical field, he could have gained some of that knowledge that could have applied to a doctor or a surgeon. So it's really interesting you brought that up. And I'm also glad, Jackie, you brought up the 11 murders instead of just the five. The five kind of seem to be the main focal point, but you're right, there are those other ones that all have a loose connection. And what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to go through some of the research I compiled, because you could go down endless rabbit holes with this and speculate all you want, but here's a couple of main other characters other than Tumblety that I want to run by you. But before I do that, this question's for Jackie. The Whitechapel neighborhood, and just a piece of trivia, Whitechapel is also the name of a killer death metal band from Knoxville, Tennessee, who have become quite popular over the years. And they took their name from that neighborhood in connection to Jack the Ripper. And before we start identifying other characters, Jackie, if you could tell us about that neighborhood, because I know you've been through it many times. What have you learned from your own tours or other tours in London that explore that part of the city and that backstory?
Well, Whitechapel really is one of those interesting areas. It's very grungy. It's probably if you think about somewhere like downtown LA. So it's been slightly gentrified, but it does have that grungy, seedy underbelly still. So you've got beautiful traditional old buildings that haven't changed at all. They would have been the same in 1888. You've got the Ten Bells pub that still stands there and hasn't changed. Oh, wow. It's still got, yeah, you should go there. It looks exactly like From Hell. It's still got the floorboards that are very basic. It's still got exactly the same look and feel, the same bar. So you can actually feel like you're in the movie if you go there. And it's one of those places. It's got these beautiful hidden little hip sort of hipster bars. But it's also got, as I mentioned, just scary little alleyways you wouldn't want to walk down. You can still see drug deals taking place in dark corners. You can still see some interesting characters where you probably would want to cross the road. So it's one of those really mixed urban areas. And especially late at night, it still does have, it still has a feel about it. It's got an edge. It is a very beautiful place to visit, but it's, yeah, it's a very edgy place.
Wow. Thank you so much for the firsthand accounts of that. Very, very cool perspective to hear. And Dan and Amy, when traveling isn't such a pain in the ass, do you guys want to book a flight and go check this out in London for ourselves? I think we should.
Sounds awesome. I'm in.
For sure.
I'd be happy to show you all around.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. We already have a guide in place. So yeah, I think that's a done deal eventually. But switching back to the present moment, I want to get everybody's opinion, and whoever wants to speak after this, feel free. We'll figure it out as we go. Here's a couple of other characters from that neighborhood and from that era who are potentially suitors to the Jack the Ripper identity. So this first one I pulled from the YouTube channel, The Infographic Show, and this was posted April 9th of 2019. Now, I have to admit, this video and the headline is kind of clickbait. It's not, the video doesn't match the headline, so to speak, on YouTube. Imagine that. But in this video and infographics, they reveal that a DNA test that was done in March of 2019 and published in a journal of forensic sciences had, in fact, fully revealed Jack the Ripper's identity. The man's name was a Polish immigrant of Aaron Kosminski. He was a barber who immigrated to London from Poland. And he was a very tortured soul. He spent time going in and out of insane asylums. And in some ways fit the profile of the Ripper and the killings. However, the scientific community does not fully agree with this prognosis, as they are basing it on a strand of DNA found on an old shawl that apparently belonged to Kosminski. But other scientists and geneticists dismiss the evidence of this theory, but yet some out there claim that with this loose scientific discovery that this man is, in fact, Jack the Ripper, or was Jack the Ripper. And another YouTube channel called Biographics, hosted by Simon Whistler, he coins the terms of people who obsessively investigate Jack the Ripper as Ripperologists. And he claims that Ripperologists don't even fully agree on Kosminski being the suspect. And this is a video that Biographics posted in November of 2019. And they said, and this was after the one that was posted on Infographics, that Kosminski is strongly suspected, but the matter has yet to be settled. So what is anybody's thoughts on Aaron Kosminski? Is he a front runner to be the Ripper as well? What are your thoughts?
Now, I would, what you mentioned, Phil, about a hair was found on his shawl, or was it one of the murdered victims?
I believe so.
So how would that
connect him to the murder? It was either his or one of the victims. I can't remember if it was him or one of the murders, but when I was watching the video, what I do remember is that the evidence that was published in the scientific journal sounded a little flimsy to me, I'll say that.
Well, yeah, I can tell you a little bit about that if you wanted me to jump. Sorry, I just cut you off, Dan.
No worries.
Okay, so what actually happened was it was the victim, Catherine Eddowes. It was from Herschel. So the acting sergeant, Amos Simpson, he was assigned the task of investigating the murder of Catherine Eddowes. He took her shawl off her body and he gave it to his wife as a present, believe it or not. I don't know why on earth you would do that. It must have been a really nice shawl. But the story goes the shawl was handed down from generation to generation and it was unwashed the entire time, which, again, I don't know why you would do that. Apparently it was. And it was sold at auction in 2007. And then what happened was they extracted DNA from the shawl, which confirmed it was that of Catherine Eddowes, based on some DNA they took from some of her descendants. And then they also said that they found some seminal fluid on the shawl, which matched a descendant of Aaron Kaminsky's. So that's how the shawl came into it. Yeah, so that apparently that was DNA evidence. But it's a little, I don't know, personally, it's a bit strange. Why wouldn't you wash a shawl all those years? I don't understand. And why would you... Why would you give the shawl to your wife when you've just pulled it off the bloodied corpse that you found on the side of a road? I really don't know.
Well, I personally think that it's amazing to be able to go back to these old infamous cases and work modern science and technology into it. But I think, Phil, even you said, and Jackie as well, that this one's a little bit flimsy, that it doesn't really fully make sense.
Well, Jackie did a really good job of filling in the gaps there on the information I wasn't able to provide. However, I think given the age and the erosion of time on an article of clothing like that, I just think generally speaking, and especially that certain geneticists and experts can't agree on this, I don't think it should be given credence as the definitive theory. However, it is a very worthwhile theory to explore. Indeed, I just don't think it's the main one, like some people claim.
Now, Jackie, a question for you. When it comes to, like, does there seem to be any, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, there's some thought that the killer was, you mentioned, a Freemason, that he might have been of royalty. Are there any instances in the murders that would show a cover-up that you know of?
Oh, that's a really good question. I personally, no, I can't really find one. I really don't know. I know what you mean. I mean, I'm just trying to have a look here at the first victim, whether or not, I've got some notes here. I'm trying to find out here.
So I think that would shed some light on whether it was like it could be a Polish immigrant or Francis Tumblety versus somebody of a higher station, because if it was a higher station, you'd probably have some evidence of cover-up, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd think so. And I couldn't find anything. Doesn't mean it's not out there. It just probably means that I haven't come across it myself.
Well, Dan and Jackie, you have come to the right place today because, and for those of the true believers who listen to March's case study on Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, 2 months straight with the case study, I went down some very strange rabbit holes in connections to these films. And for this one, I actually did some research and was able to find a potentially very heavy Masonic connection to everything. So we're going to get to that in just a few minutes, and your mind might be blown with some of the things I found. But first, I just want to say, even though we're talking about a lot of murders, this is not a true crime podcast. So I want to get into some of the more spiritual and esoteric and possible occult connections to this, which is going to tie in with the Freemasons, which I'll get to soon. But I want to switch to Amy briefly, because when we were recording, she told me about some information about Jack possibly being involved in the occult or devil worship. So Amy, what do you got for us?
Yeah, I was reading today that he could be worshiping Satan, so satanic worship, and the motive to kill 4 prostitutes as the occult, the creed, and in so doing, profane the Christian cross. So apparently the way they were laid out was in the shape of a cross.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I think there is a ritualistic aspect of this. And with that being said, I do want to tie this into the Masonic connection. Now, I'm going to get to Jackie in the minute because she's like right in the middle of like where Freemasonry kind of exploded and, you know, is almost like the central headquarters of it. But Dan, I want to bring this back to you for a minute. Downtown Hamilton, a little bit west of where you do your ghost tour, we have the Scottish Rite building, and right beside it is the Grand Lodge of Freemasonry, I believe, for all of Canada.
Yes.
First off, are you aware of any haunting or paranormal activity involved in either one of those buildings? Because I thought I heard the Scottish Rite in Hamilton had some stuff going on with it.
I am actually very familiar. The Scottish Rite building, I did the ghost tour there for about 5 years and did the a Halloween costume ball once a year in that building. Oh. So, yeah, we got familiar with Freemason lore, Masonic history, and, of course, the building itself, which has a few ghosts in there. As for the Grand Lodge beside it for all of Ontario, I am not very familiar with that building, but the Scottish Rite for sure.
Yeah, they probably wouldn't even let you into that building, to say the least. And I'm only speaking about this, about my own experience. I don't know much about the Order. I don't have any friends or family connected to them. But when I do research on this kind of Order society, I get a real funny feeling in my heart chakra. Because there's some things that appear off to me about it. And I'm going to get to Jackie very quickly. But Dan, I just want to ask one more question in relation to this. When you did those costume balls and the tours of the Scottish Rite, did you sense or notice anything off other than the usual paranormal activity? Or did you have an easy time dealing with them?
There was one difference. Now, the Scottish Rite is made up of a cathedral that was made by the Freemasons in the 20s, but as well an 1800s Victorian mansion. And the mansion itself has ghosts and energy from the family who live there, the Tuckets. But the Freemason element, I'll stick with just that, otherwise we'll be here all day. But the Freemason element, what I would say to it is that we were allowed to go into spaces that were pretty... like it would be sacrilegious, and it's terrible to say now, but for women to go into these spaces. And the one thing I did notice is when we brought groups with women in it, that it did tend to stir stuff up, and many of the experiences that we had were from those areas that were previously really locked down. So that's something that stood out to me.
Oh, that is so interesting. We're going to find out a little bit about how the Order works and why that might happen. But I just wanted to point out that so amazing having someone from London on here, because the oldest Freemason Grand Lodge apparently started in London back in 1775. And there's the Masonic Temple at Andaz, London, which is a little ways northwest of the Whitechapel neighborhood. And I believe now, from the website, it's a Hyatt hotel that before the pandemic, it would rent out the old temple to, like, you know, weddings and parties and stuff like that. So, Jackie, you're almost in the complete center of Freemasonic history. So what have your dealings been with them, if any? And if so, what are your theories as to how it might connect with Jack the Ripper?
Well, you've given me homework to do here. I really don't know much about the Masons at all, and I'm excited now. I've got something to explore. It's dark and it's winter here in London, so it's perfect for me to go walk around on my own and find out. But the one thing I do know, of course, is that main clue, which was the scrawling on the wall, the Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing. And Jews, of course, was misspelt, J-U-W-E-S. So people felt that that was a misspelling, but other people say that Jews, that spelling actually refers to a Masonic ritual, and the Masonic ritual involves cutting a throat, then cutting open a chest, and placing lungs over a victim's shoulder. So if that's correct, I need to look more into that. But if that is correct, that's exactly how those five main victims were murdered, of course. Their throats were slit left to right. Their abdomens were opened up, and some of them did have their reproductive organs lying on top of them or underneath the bed. So there's a strong connection there, which I need to look into more.
Yeah. I'm going to give you some material on that actually later in the interview, not too long before we wrap up. But I also find that geographical proximity is no coincidence. Like the Masonic Temple I just mentioned, it's a little ways northwest of Whitechapel. And when I did Sleepy Hollow with Amy last month, we found out that Sleepy Hollow Cemetery has a list of American elites who are also Freemasons and also had members of the alleged 13 families who ruled the world. And just a ways east of Sleepy Hollow, New York, was a massive reserve and mansion where the Rockefellers used to reside and do God knows what in there. So, I mean, like I said, geographical proximity is a big deal. And then you brought in the whole ritualistic aspect of it. Ian Holm gives an excellent performance in this movie as Dr. William Gull, who in this story, which is based off the graphic novel, is the man who is essentially behind this. And he's a Freemason. Okay. And not only that, but a lot of the highest order of doctors, police, the legal system are all members of the Freemasonic Society in this movie. Now, the reason I bring this up is that the conspiracy that gets unleashed in the movie From Hell is about one of these Freemasons who are in the royal family. Prince Albert marries one of these ladies of the night and has a child with her out of wedlock and gets married in a Catholic church. And real quick, I just want to explain, because I did a little bit of research on this, the friction between Catholicism and Freemasonry. Because to me, the Freemasons get accused of all sorts of ritualistic madness, occult activity, what have you. And I wanted to find out why they have this negative perception. And with that being said, they are also an order filled with a lot of secrecy that have had a lot of powerful people in their order over the years. So there could be something. But here's a couple of examples. This first one is from John Salza. I also saw this on YouTube. I watched part of a video on what he lists as the hidden dangers of Freemasonry. He claims it takes men away from Jesus Christ. Temples and buildings are built near Catholic churches on purpose just to make their presence known. And there's a scene in From Hell where you see a man in an underground Mason meeting go through the ritual, the initiation ritual. And it's kind of bizarre and kind of weird looking. And one incredible synchronicity I found watching this video from John Salza was that, so what happened to him was he got recruited late high school, early college to join the Masons, and he did. And then he eventually went back to his Catholic roots and wanted to kind of do a tell all about them. The Masonic ritual in the scene in From Hell is described exactly the same way as what Salza went through. So I think the ritual initiation scene in the movie is very realistic based on what this gentleman said. And here are some paraphrased quotes from an article on CatholicWorldReport.com written in February 2017 by Sandra Meisel. I think that's her name anyway. Pope Leo XIII denounced the Masonic Lodge as deceitful and a crafty enemy. Many Catholics view Freemasonry as a dangerous and possibly satanic conspiracy to destroy their faith. Freemasons pretend to preserve ancient secrets handed down from Solomon's builders and pagan mystery cults via the medieval Knights Templar, esotericism, and symbols through architecture. Knights of Columbus formed as a Catholic alternative to Freemasonry. So you got the Masons and the Knights of Columbus. And I didn't get too deep into this, but there was some scandal in, I believe, 1981, where some Masons in the Vatican Bank were outed as posing as Catholics in secret, and that created a whole, I think, even a bigger division between them and the Catholic Church. The reason I brought all that up was that the whole conspiracy of Jack the Ripper in From Hell is predicated on the rivalry between the Freemasons and the Catholic Church, and how they really can't seem to stand one another. Now, just to bring this up, and then we'll have another group discussion, and then we'll start wrapping things up here. And thank you again for joining us, everybody. Similar to what Amy said earlier about how the bodies were almost laid out like inverted crosses, there's a lot of energetic ritual behind the symbolism of, like, the way the murders happened, where the bodies were placed. And also, I just wanted to bring this up real quick. The year 1888, I don't think that's an accident, because I believe symbols and numbers have an energy and a frequency all on their own. There is an energetic frequency behind 888, and it is of mastery and personal power. And I think if you look deeper on the internet too, you will find more energetic meanings of 1888, the number itself. And you could go into gematria and all that stuff. I won't get into that here because it's too long and complicated. But basically, I think that year having these murders is no coincidence, and it's kind of forms into the ritual. So upon the conclusion of my research, I thought, yeah, this is a cool story. It could be based in some semblance of reality, but likely not. And then I happened to find something that I thought was quite startling. There's an author named John Hamer, H-A-M-E-R. He is English, and he has written a lot of, what would we say, conspiracy alternative theory books. And he has a book, came out quite a few years ago, called The Falsification of History. And in this book, it suggests that Prince Eddie, the brother of future King George V, hooked up with a woman named Annie Crook, who was also the character in the movie. And Eddie was a Mason, she was a Catholic. And then baby Alice Margaret, who's also in the movie, was born on April 18th of 1885. Hamer goes on to say in this book that he believes, and this is kind of where I lean towards personally, but like I said, it's just a theory. He believes that the Ripper wasn't a single person, but part of a group who carried out ritualistic Masonic slaughter. And allegedly, one of the Freemasons involved in this was Lord Randolph Spencer Churchill, who was the son of future Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And another author by the name of Stephen Knight, I believe, was working on a book and a film to expose this hidden story in history. And he was apparently poisoned at the age of 33. His murder is unsolved. And for anyone who knows the slightest thing about Freemasonry, is that the highest degree is the 33rd degree. And that number and that symbol appears everywhere. So John Hamer, J-O-N-H-A-M-E-R, he has a very fascinating alternative look at the possible identity and conspiracy involving Jack the Ripper. And it goes into the Catholics versus Masons rivalry, so to speak. So a lot to unpack there, but please jump in with your thoughts on this possibly being a grand conspiracy played out on the silver screen in front of us.
Wow, there is a lot to unpack there, but I guess a lot of people do suggest there were two different people operating as Jack the Ripper, or a group, as you said, especially because of the double murder on the 30th of September, when Catherine Eddowes' body was found, and so was Elizabeth Stride's body. So that would explain that. And the other thing is the two letters that were sent in by Jack the Ripper were very, very different, different handwriting, different style. And a lot of people say that the two letters were probably written by two different people. So I can see how it could all fit in together.
Yeah, and in John Hamer's work, I also believe I read that they have the same narrative as the movie, where a bunch of the letters that ended up at the police station were in fact written by his halfway illiterate coachman as well. So very, very interesting to unpack there. So either way, I lean towards this being a group murder, just because the fact that it's never ever been solved and that nobody can agree upon who it might be. I could see a potentially powerful organization banding together and having several individuals or several steps banding together to keep this whole conspiracy or whatnot secret. You just never know. So in closing, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask each one individually. I said where my theory lies, and I want to get the answer from each and every one of you. So in your opinion, in your heart and soul, who was Jack the Ripper? And I'll start with you, Amy.
I'm not sure. This is a tough one. I do believe he was an educated man, for sure. No one could cut those organs that way. I think possibly it was definitely a cover-up to someone in, like, the higher, like, royalty, like in the movie. They were trying to cover that up, for sure, I think.
Yeah, that's a strong possibility, for sure. Okay, who do you think the Ripper was? Yes.
Well, even though Jackie did try to shoot it down a few minutes ago, but I have to stick with Francis Tumblety, you know, because I have to stick with local. But I don't know enough about the overall subject. The idea that there was more than one killer, just the fact that it did confuse Scotland Yard and did confuse people so much, even today, not being able to step back and confirm who it might have been. Yeah, I think that's evidence of a cover-up, even though we haven't really talked much about that side of it. But that aside, Francis Tumblety.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, it's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. But I think, I think Dr. Gull could be a suspect. I'm with you. Originally I thought of Frederick Bailey Deeming, but now that I've heard what you have to say, and also with Dr. Gull, you know, a lot of people believe that Prince Albert impregnated Mary Kelly, so the first murder victim, and she was the only one under 40 years of age. She was quite well-spoken. She had a more refined background. So it's quite possible that he did impregnate her and the royal family tried to cover it up. So the theory is Dr. Gull actually came and maybe covered it up and murdered her. And then also the royal family murdered the other women as a cover-up, so it looked like a serial killer on the loose instead of, Mary Kelly being the prime victim. And there could be a little bit of, the Masons being involved and the church being involved. So I think he's a pretty good suspect. He had the knowledge. Some people say he was 72 years of age at the time, so he wouldn't have been able to have the strength. But at the end of the day, a lot of these women were murdered from behind with their throats slashed left to right with a sharp scalpel. So I think he could have had the strength to do that if he had the right equipment, and he would have had the knowledge to remove their organs. But, of course, my other one, if I can have two, is Frederick Bailey Deeming. Am I allowed to talk about him? So Frederick Bailey Deeming.
Go ahead.
Yeah, he's one of my favourites. I've always thought it could be him too. So he spent a lot of time at sea. He lived between South Africa, England and Australia. And he contracted syphilis because he used to like to visit the ladies of the night. And, of course, that is known to make a lot of these people go a little bit crazy and insane. And he actually ended up marrying a woman and having a family and taking them up north in England to a place near Liverpool. And his family disappeared, so he was brokenhearted, and he went to Australia and he ended up remarrying and had another family. And he had a lot of misfortune because that family also disappeared. And then years later, some people were looking through his house in Liverpool in England, and they smelled a terrible smell from the fireplace, dug up the floorboards, and there was his wife and his children from his first marriage. So Frederick Bailey Deeming murdered his family in England, then they found out he murdered his family in Australia. And he also was around Whitechapel at the time of the Ripper murders. So he was a prime suspect. So he's one of mine as well.
Yeah. I think every single theory and person of interest in this discussion is valid, because we just don't know. And we may never know, especially if there was a cover-up administered by the Freemasons, the royal family, or both, or some other secret society we don't even know about. I loved talking about this because even though it didn't go into the normal unexplained paranormal realm, I do believe there is heavy spiritual energy behind this entire case, who was involved with it, who covered it up, and the whole feud with the Catholics and the Masons is like a form of spiritual warfare. And the fact too that in the movies, Gall and Inspector Aberline had what they thought were psychic visions and premonitions and glimpses into the future. So it all ties in to the unexplained banner. And I can't thank you three enough for coming on here. So we're going to wrap now. And I just want to get everyone's final thoughts or touch on anything we may have missed. And excuse me for Dan and Jackie, this is a chance to plug your upcoming tours once again. So I'll start. Amy, is there anything else you want to add or anything we may have missed here?
No, I think we got it covered.
All right. Awesome. Thank you for joining me again. We'll chat up in May for sure on the next case study, but Dan, final thoughts, and let us know what's going on with tour season, even though things are a little unpredictable at the moment.
No kidding. Final thoughts, really not much to say. I'm not much of an expert when it came to Jack the Ripper, and I've been absolutely fascinating listening to all of you. And Jackie, you definitely know your stuff. But in the end, yeah, I just think it really is going to remain a mystery. But as for the tours, you mentioned Phil Hamilton is shut down again, so that's not happening. But Niagara on the Lake is okay, so I'm going to be doing the Niagara on the Lake tours every weekend in April.
Well, Dan, I'm glad you're touring, but I only snicker because it's absurd that, you know, 30 to 40 minutes down the highway you can do this, and then the other end of it you can't. Like, it's just, yeah. I'm not even getting that discussion right now.
I need to make it very clear that we are extremely careful, even with the groups that we do have, social distancing and masks and everything, as I'm sure, Jackie, you can relate to that. But when it comes to, yeah, the regions and why they're deciding to lock them down, it's just that your guess is as good as mine.
I'm just going to paraphrase a quote from my close friend. Talking about this, he used the term political farce, and I couldn't agree more. And I just wanted to say, Dan, I did two of your tours last summer, and yeah, you're distancing and like you're doing everything right. So I mean, it's unfair that part of your business gets punished for this, but we hope you bounce back. And Jackie, final thoughts, and give us an update on the other side of the Atlantic.
Yeah, sure. Well, final thoughts. I just wanted to mention that the Whitechapel area is haunted, and the staff at the Ten Bells Hotel or the Ten Bells Pub believe that Annie Chapman haunts the building, because all of the ladies who were murdered frequented that building, and often they'd find clients that way. So they have got a poltergeist that has moved furniture. Sometimes glasses are moved around. The wine glasses have been switched around. And they said sometimes when it's a busy night, they'll be preparing drinks and turn around and items are being moved or thrown off the counter. So they believe Annie Chapman's spirit is haunting the building. And the other thing is, a couple of the ladies who work there and sleep upstairs, they've got staff quarters upstairs, they've told me they've seen a man with dark hair, dark eyes and a Victorian outfit wandering around upstairs. And one of them said to me that this man jumped into bed with her one night. She screamed and he vanished. So we do have some ghosts haunting the Whitechapel area. It is an interesting place to visit from that perspective too. I don't know if this man's Jack the Ripper, by the way, because apparently Jack the Ripper had dark eyes, dark hair, or maybe it's just another patron. But, yeah, so tours, in terms of tours in England, we're in lockdown, so we're not operating, but we should be coming out of that in May. We're aiming to start tours up again in England. And in Australia, we're all systems go, which is great. And thanks again, guys, for involving me. Good luck with everything. Dan, good luck, with the tours as well when you finally open up. I think it's fantastic.
Thanks, Jackie. All... Same to you.
Yeah, thank you. I know it's been hard for everyone. It's just great that you're promoting the history and the heritage of areas and making history exciting for people and, entertaining people in general. So keep up the great work.
Yeah, and I just want to say in closing that this past year when I started this show, everyone, like I've met everyone virtually. Like, you know, Dan's one of the few I've met in person from the show. But there's going to be a day where we can all sit around, we can have a drink or two, and then maybe even do like a podcast or something with like the four of us. Whether it's here, whether it's in England, doesn't matter. We'll make it work down the line somehow. And thank you all again for joining. Thank you to, of course, Angel Card Amy, Dan Cumerlato, and Jackie Trevelia. That was a fun episode. I want to maybe try and do this more often. Group chats, they're a little tough to coordinate, but once you get them all going, they're a lot of fun, and I think everybody brought something to the table and did very well. Well, near the end of that interview, I was talking with Dan about the restrictions and the rules, how some of them aren't making any sense. Well, at the time of recording this outro, we're less than 12 hours away in our region from being in a full shutdown again, or what's close to a full shutdown. It's so confusing right now, I can't even keep track. But unfortunately, it looks like the ghost tours are not going to be resuming till at least May and possibly June of 2021. If you want to hear more of my thoughts and opinions on this, you can check out Phantom Phil Unexplained _ between the words, as I did an IGTV broadcast early in the day on Good Friday, and I get into this a bit more. And I also set out the full lineups for Unexplained Incorporated for April and May. So I would very much appreciate it if you gave me a follow and if you check that out as well. So next week on Unexplained Incorporated, going to stick somewhat with the true crime realm of things. So I originally had another ghost tour company on my radar for this week. That unfortunately did not work out, probably due to some of the climate that's going on here currently, and they have other things to deal with, but that's okay. As I am actually, by God, having a small family get together over Easter, and I'm going to see my brother in the flesh, and he is the host of The Trail Went Cold. We're going to talk about some true crime cases where unexplained phenomenon and the paranormal played a major part, and what did law enforcement do about these cases, or were they able to solve these cases? For those of you that remember, he came on last June to do the case study on the movie Ghost with me, which is something him and I both watched growing up, and we connected the dots loosely to a case in late 70s Chicago where there was a murder and the murderer was apprehended due to evidence that was provided possibly from beyond the grave. And that was a really fun episode to do. He brought some of his listeners along with him. But we're going to explore different types of true crime cases that involve like the occult, satanic ritual, cult-like behaviors, and some weird unexplained phenomenon and possession and along those things. And when weird stuff like this goes down, where does the law enter and where does it take its place? It's really difficult to tell. So that's going to be a really fun one, and he's going to be on the mic in person with me. He's one of the very few people who's been able to do an in-person interview with me since I started this thing in the middle of the pandemic. And don't worry, we're taking all the precautions, we're staying safe, and that'll be a really good time. That's going to be April 9th next week on Unexplained Incorporated. Well, at the time of this recording, I wish each and every one of you and yours a very happy Easter. Hopefully restrictions and whatnot haven't ruined it too badly for you. But I know you guys, I know the true believers, you're tough. You'll make the best of it. And on that note, it is time to sign off, and I will tell you to stay strong, stay healthy, and by God, stay curious. The doors of Unexplained Incorporated are now closed.